Welcome to the Broadway Radio Show. I'm Donald Feltham, and I have a special guest with me on this episode. She is not only a wonderful singer, but she's also an actress and an educator and an activist, and she's a 13-time MAC Award winner. I'm talking about Natalie Douglas. Hi, Natalie. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Hello. I'm good. She's got a new album out on Club 44 Records called Back to the Garden, which is available on download and streaming and on and physical CDs as well.
That's
which
right.
We love. So if you like physical CDs, which I have it on my hot little hands right now, you can purchase an album. It's your fourth album. Congratulations. It's a fantastic, fantastic album.
Thank you. I love
but
it.
Before we jump into the music, let's give the listeners a little bit of your background if they don't know who you are. You are a big kind of a mainstay in the New York cabaret and jazz world. But if they are not familiar with you, talk about where you grew up and kind of how you got involved in music and performing.
Sure. I'm originally from Los Angeles.
That's where I grew up. Okay.
LA girl, born and bred.
Where did you grow up? I'm just curious.
I grew up in Windsor Hills. I went to Westlake School for Girls.
Got it.
Graduated early at 16, then went to UC Riverside for 1 year, but then graduated in 2 years from USC undergrad and UCLA grad. My godfather, who was my mother's cousin, was the mayor of Los Angeles for 20 years, Tom Bradley.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, that's interesting. I'm a native Angeleno myself.
Yes. Ah, yeah.
Born and raised, yes.
Yeah. Where'd you go to school?
I was actually raised in Downey.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Wow. So I went to Warren High School in Downey. So I'm way ahead of you though. So I suspect I've got many years on you. But yes, I have a native Los Angeles, and of course Tom Bradley, who our airport is named after Tom. The terminal, the Bradley terminal, is named after the wonderful
Makes
Tom
me
Bradley.
Very happy every time I fly in. Yeah,
yes.
I mean, I know it's the international terminal, but
still, it's the Bradley terminal. Yeah. Yes, go ahead.
He was actually a lovely man.
Yes.
So yeah, I grew up in LA. It was a fantastic in LA. I loved growing up there. But I came to visit friends from UCLA who had moved to New York. I came to visit them and they took me to a piano bar so I could sing. I always sang, you know, for friends, coffee house. I don't know if you remember Monty's in Westwood.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Because I went to UCLA also.
Yeah. It existed. I don't know if it's still there. I mean, It was in that sort of one high rise that was in Westwood. Mm-hmm. It was up at the roof.
It was on the rooftop. Yeah.
Yeah. And there on Sunday and Mondays, there was a guy who played guitar there. And he was a friend of a friend. We went to see him one night. We happened to be sitting near him. And an LA Ram, whose name I don't know because I'm not a football person, but a very attractive man, came over and gave him $100 and said, "Can you sing Blue Bayou?" And he said, "I can play it, but I don't know the lyrics." And he looked at me and he said, "Natalie, you're a singer. Do you know it?" And I said, "Yeah, actually." See? So I stood up. I stood up and I sang it and it was really fun. And then I sat down again. He goes, no, here, take the chip. And I was like, no, that's for you. And he's like, no, you sang it. And I thought, well, it doesn't suck. You know, so I was 19 when I went to grad school. That was a lot of money for a grad school kid. And the manager came over to me and said, you know, I can't pay you, but if you want to come in here and sing on Sunday and Mondays, I'll give you steak dinner. And
I was like,
that's awesome. I'm sold. You know, so that was one of my first gigs in LA. But I did a lot of open mics and I had friends who were always sort of saying, oh, come on, sing, you know, all these random places, parties, all kinds of things.
But did you grow up in a musical household? I mean, was music a part of growing up?
Yeah. I mean, they took me to a lot of live performances. One of my earliest memories is seeing the Count Basie Orchestra when they came through. I mean, the Count was no longer with them, but they came through, I think it was the Long Beach Auditorium, which probably isn't there anymore, probably called something else. But I remember that the first act was the orchestra themselves, and they were fantastic and brilliant. And then the second act was the orchestra featuring Joe Williams and Nancy Wilson. And Nancy Wilson was actually a neighbor at the time. She lived in our neighborhood. And it was it was just spectacular. I mean, it was like one of the best things I'd ever seen in my life. And I remember when Joe began to sing, he was singing the verse to Something to Live For, and he was in front of the curtain and the orchestra was behind the curtain. And so there was nothing on stage, but this gorgeous man in a beautiful suit singing a very like sort of intimate solo. And I could feel the entire audience, this packed auditorium, like hesitate to breathe. Mm-hmm. You know, just mm-hmm. kind of be completely captivated by him. And I remember looking at my mother, and I was like a little kid, like 4 or 5. And I looked at my mother and said, that, I want to do that. She, of course, said, no, you will be a professional.
well, you are lawyer, a professional
doctor.
Now.
I am. But, you know, she wanted a lawyer. She wanted a doctor, one of those. But yeah, that, I mean, she taught me to sing when I was 4. So it was something I always did. And I remember just kind of whenever I would learn a song, whenever I would find, you know, I would watch television or listen to the radio, or my parents had a great record collection, listen to one of their records, you know, and they had everything from South Pacific 78, mm-hmm. you know, to Dolly Parton, to Stevie Wonder, to Fleetwood Mac, to Ray Charles, you know, Nancy Wilson. Giselle McKenzie Christmas album, one of my favorites. So I had this really fantastically eclectic input, you know, and whenever I learned a song, there was this little voice in my head that would say, I'm a singer. Yeah, that's what I do. I'm a singer. So that I didn't let that voice out for a really long time. It was kind of my secret with myself, but I always kind of knew this is who I am. And I came to visit friends in New York. They took me to a piano bar to sing in their open mic. But, you know, we were there all evening enjoying it. And the waitress came over and said, Danny wants to talk to you. And I thought, okay, I don't know who that is. And she took me to the bar and introduced me to the then manager, a man who later became a dear friend. And he said, do you want a job? And I said, I don't live here. I live in LA. Mm-hmm. And he said, move to New York and I'll give you a job. So I did. It wow. was like another year, but I moved to New York and he gave me a job in the piano bar. And that was my day job for 20 years while I auditioned for shows and I sort of built up the repertoire and created this sort of concert cabaret life that now is what sustains me. But yeah, that was my entry to New York performance. It was kind of fantastic.
But when you went to college, I mean, you have, I read it, did my homework, uh-huh. but you graduated from USC with bachelor's in psychology, theater, and women's studies. And then you got your master's at UCLA in psychology and theater, right? So you did have the fallback of psychology.
Yes, I did. My mother was a psychologist.
Oh, okay.
So it was, again, a family business. Mm-hmm. And I discovered that I found it particularly useful as an actor.
Yes, I was going to say.
and, you know, navigating the world. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I've always been fascinated by stories and people. And you know, that's what psychology is. That's what theater is. That's mm-hmm. what all these things are, music. You know, it's the stories we tell ourselves, about others, the true stories, the stories we tell, and then the truth underneath, you know, mm-hmm. all of that I find fascinating. So I've always been drawn to songs because of the stories they tell and the ways in which you can hear a song that you've never heard before in your life and within a few seconds begin to say, oh my God, that's me. You know, mm-hmm. that's my story. I see myself in this song. I've always been fascinated by that. And I think it does something magical. And I also think it's something that we as human beings need and crave. We need to be seen. We need to be heard. And we need to be somewhat social, you know, somewhat connected. Even if I'm an extroverted introvert, you know, even as an introverted person who needs my alone time, I need that human connection. Mm-hmm. As we all saw during lockdown, you know, one of the things that people did was figure out this format of right. being together when we couldn't be together, so that we could connect. And we find it, I think it's like air to us as human beings. And so I have always been fascinated by all the things that connect us, which is why I'm also a history geek and a politics geek, and, you know, in addition to theater and books and music. I am fascinated by the things that bind us. And I grew up in a household where all those things were valued. So even though my mother was not thrilled when I announced
I'm going to New York to sing a bar.
Yeah. You know, she couldn't really say it was a huge surprise because I spent my life doing this. You know, she's the one who sent me to drama classes when I was 6 years old.
Oh, well, yeah.
You know, and dance and Girl Scouts. And I was one of those extracurricular girls. You know, I played the harp and the piano and sang. And, you know, it was just, you know, her intention, I think, was I want you to be a well-rounded adult. And good. I'm glad. That's a lofty goal and a good one. But it was also, you know, show business.
Right.
You know, so, and I was growing up in LA in the 70s. I mean, you know, surrounded by show business. I went to a private girls' school. A lot of my friends' parents were in the business.
And, yeah.
You know, I spent a lot of time on sets and in studios when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And I was on TV when I was five, you know, that KTLA had some like kid program that I was tapped to be in a couple episodes of. I mean, everybody
yeah.
in LA was
yeah.
in the business, you know, in some way or another.
Believe me, I know.
I know. I mean,
it's part of the culture here.
Yeah.
It is.
It's actually one of the things that I found fascinating about New York when I first came here, and people weren't in the business. You know, some people weren't. Some people did other things. It was amazing. I also fell in love with the seasons, you know, as much as I love, and I do, I still love LA. I mean, it's home and it holds so much of my heart. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I fell in love. I came here for the first time in the fall. And so I fell in love with the seasons and walking through the park. And I was like, I'm sold. Where do I sign up? And somebody offered me a job. So it took me about a year. But a little over a year, I moved here.
But when you moved, as you said, you moved, you know, with the guarantee of you have a job, as you said, mm-hmm. through your day job. But you were still auditioning for things.
Yeah.
So in your mind, I'm assuming that you were not necessarily thinking to yourself, "Well, I'm going. My job now is going to be my career is going to be as a singer."
No,
you hadn't made that career decision at that point, right?
No, I had not. No, I was an actor and I studied theater, not musical theater. So I thought of singing as the separate thing that I did, that I'd always done, that I love, that it was, you know, a part of who I am, but had nothing to do with career.
Right.
But the more I sang in public places, the more I sang in front of strangers, the more I began to realize and began to hear from people that they enjoyed this and they weren't already friends of mine or related to me, you know? And so I began to entertain the idea that, that maybe singing is something I could do, because I did a lot of my acting teacher. I worked with Carol Ligario at USC and Michael McLean at UCLA, you know, who were brilliant, brilliant instructors. And they talked a lot about the work of an actor in song, how it is not different than the work of an actor in monologue or in dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And how you can turn a song into one, like how to find your beats and your objectives and your conflict and raise the stakes and all of that within the text of a song. So I had learned that in that world. And I also, as I said, grew up listening to and going to see people like Joe Williams and Nancy Wilson. And my dad was somebody who really loved both like R&B and you know, pop and that world. But he also loved country music and he loved rock. So when I was about, I don't know, like maybe 12, my dad took me to a Moody Blues concert.
Oh my God. Uh-huh.
Was awesome. And, you know, I grew up in the time when kids, little bit older than I was, were going to the Troubadour. And so I went to this all-girls school, which was K through 12. So, you know, when I was a 7-year-old, some of the seniors would come and talk about going to see these bands, you know, going to see Linda Ronstadt and the Stone Ponies, you know, and like, I was just fascinated by it. And I thought it sounded amazing. So I was immersed in this means of telling story of connecting with other human beings. And I actually, a few years ago, 2017, I guess it was, I started a series at Birdland, which is my New York City concert home. I love that club. And I was doing a monthly residency, and each month I would do a different tribute to a different artist. So we did Sammy Davis Jr. and Nina Simone, who is my all-time goddess, and Linda Ronstadt, and Shirley Bassey. And then the second year we did 6 of them, and then the third year we did 11 of them, which was crazy. It was a lot of fun, but I enjoyed doing the research part too. And I read Linda Ronstadt's autobiography, which is wonderful. It's a great book. And she writes about how surprised people were that she, you know, changed genres throughout her career. But for her, none of that was a surprise, because those are all the things she listened to growing up. You know, her family, she had, you know, classical artists in her family, a very famous opera singer from Mexico, who is, I think, an aunt of hers, a great aunt maybe. So she grew up with all of these styles of music. And she said that everything that she later recorded and surprised people with were things that she sang with her family before the age of 10.
Right.
You know, and I realized that that's sort of how I approached this as I was reading her story, you know, that everything that I was exposed to, all of these different styles, are things that I love. My parents were much older when they adopted me. So they had a love of standards, and they shared that love of me with me. So, you know, I grew up loving Irving Berlin and Duke Ellington and Cole Porter, and, you know, they love that music. And, but, you know, I also love the 70s and the pop sort of country rock folk hybrid thing that is an LA sound.
The LA sound. Yeah, the 70s, you know, of course.
Yeah, Carla Donna, Andrew Gold,
the Laurel Canyon stuff, right?
Yeah, I love that. You know, but I'm also a Joni fan, and being a political creature, I also love the music of the 60s, the activist music, you know. Right. So I found this way in cabaret and this nightclub world to create these shows that kind of speak to all of these things that I love, and I can craft something that celebrates all of these pieces of it.
My very next note on my notes was to talk about your tribute concerts, because they are all over the map. I mean, you hit Ella Fitzgerald, Nina Simone, and you just said Sammy Davis Jr., but you also hit Cher and Dolly Parton and Joni Mitchell, and it shows the huge diversity of musical styles that you grew up with. And I'm kind of the same way, because I grew up in a household that wasn't kind of a traditional American household. So because I was the first US born in my family. So they listened to everything. So we had all sorts of music in my household. And so I grew up like you did, with a real diverse playlist. I mean, it was just everything all over the map. So I listened to all sorts of things, and I still do.
Yeah. I think that's great. I mean, I actually remember a time when it felt like radio stations were more varied, you know. Of course there were niches, you know, but on one station you might hear a pop hit, and you might also hear, you know, a show tune, like,
right,
you know. Before, I mean, I remember reading a few years ago that until the Hamilton cast album, the most recent show tune that had hit the pop charts and Billboard charts was Louis Armstrong singing Hello, Dolly. You know, that is a huge gap in terms of how many years between the sort of music of everyday people.
Right.
Included Broadway, Mm-hmm. And then stopped including that music for a really long time. So I kind of miss that when you could just, and it's how I program what I listen to at home. And it's how I program, you know, my shows.
Right. And it's also a perfect segue because it's how you program your album. Because
yeah.
Let's talk about the album, because Back to the Garden is a very eclectic mix of songs. So talk about the process of how you got together with your team, particularly Wayne Hahn and the rest of your group, to talk about choosing these songs, because you've got Cole Porter, you've got Joni Mitchell, you've got an Oscar-winning song, you've got a Sherman Brothers Disney song, you've got a song written specifically for you, you've got a Lionel Bart song from Shirley Bassey, you've got all sorts of things. So talk about the process of sitting down and coming up with the songs for this, because that's always something that's really tricky for these albums is,
oh yeah,
because it's,
oh, yeah,
so it's reflective of who you are, and mm-hmm. and you've got to sit down and figure out what songs and what order you want to put the songs in and what the arrangements are going to be. So talk about your process.
Well, in this instance, it was a slightly different process because this is my first album with a label signed with Club 44 Records, whom I adore. I love them so much, by the way. They have just, the entire experience has been wonderful. So it was slightly different than the other three times we did albums. But it has been 6 years, 7 years since I released the last album. So because I perform a lot and travel a lot, I have this sort of running list of things people say to me after a concert. Oh my gosh, please tell me that's recorded. Which album is that song on? You know, have you recorded the Dolly Show yet? Oh my God, I want that album. You know, so there are certain songs that I know people are waiting for, you know, which means a lot to me because it validates for me. Yeah, that song resonates with me too, when the audience tells me that they love it. So there were those songs that were in the back of my mind. And then having done all of these different shows, there's certain songs from each one that I just can't get enough of, you know? So I had this kind of running list in my mind. And when Wayne and I first sat down to meet, you know, we had lunches and we'd known each other for a little while. But before the first official meeting, he said, you know, put some stuff together, make a list. So I did, and it had 63 songs on it.
Okay.
It was excessive.
Yeah. Natalie Douglas's box set.
Exactly. You know, Barbara can do it. Why not?
Right.
Yeah. So I knew we were going to be winnowing away, you know, but I thought better to go in with this vast array and kind of figure out where we land than to be scrambling to add something, you know? So we just started talking and singing through things. And Wayne had ideas, things he really wanted me to do, things he wanted to hear. Like True Colors was a song I have always loved. Not just because as a song, but also because of what it says and what it's come to mean to the queer community. Mm-hmm. But I never thought of singing it. You know, I know other people who do and do it beautifully. And Cyndi Lauper's version, of course, is fabulous. So it was not on my radar as a song to sing. But Wayne said, you know, I really want to hear what you would do with this. And so we sang it through a couple of times and I was instantly in tears. And I thought, oh, okay, yeah, I guess we do have to record this. And so sort of that, it came down to certain things that are me, you know, the title comes from Woodstock.
Right.
And I have always loved that song. And about 2012, I guess it was, I did a show for the first time called Freedom Songs, which was my political show. Although all my shows are political, really. I mean, I'm a Black woman in America, right? everything I do is political. But that one specifically was. And I grew up loving both Joni Mitchell's version of Woodstock and Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, you know, that version. And they're very different. But I had always wanted to figure out a way to put them together. So my longtime music director, Mark Hartman, who's also my best friend, we came up with a version that combined them. So that was something that I'd been singing for
for about 10, 11 years now. I guess it's 12 years going on. It's Joni is a genius, which everyone knows. But I love that David Crosby said that Joni wrote about Woodstock better than people who were at Woodstock, you know, and she couldn't go because her manager had booked her on the Dick Cavett show. So he didn't. So she wrote about it from things people told her, which is amazing. And she wrote that lyric that we are stardust. We are billion-year-old carbon, you know, which is wild. I mean, because it's so poetic and also so scientifically accurate. We are a carbon-based life form, and we are made up of old exploded stars. So Woodstock for me has always been this song that reminds me of what we can be when we are at our best as human beings. So I say before I sing the song that no matter how bad things get at any given moment, politically or culturally or socially in our world, I know that this song reminds me we're made of stardust, so we're bound to shine.
Well, I came upon a child of God. He was walking along a road, and I asked him, "Tell me, where are you going?" This he told me. Said, "I'm going down to Yasker's farm, gonna join in a rock and roll band. Got to get back to the land and set my soul free. We are stardust, we are golden, we are billion-year-old carbon, and we've got to get ourselves back to the garden." "Well, then can I walk beside you? I have come to lose the smog, and I feel myself a cog in something turning. Well, and maybe it's the time of year, yes, and maybe it's the time of a man, but I don't know who I am, and life is for learning. We are stardust, we are golden, we are billion-year-old carbon, and we've got
and I would close concerts with it. So it became kind of a calling card. And a couple of years ago, I was putting together a 60s show, and we named it Back to the Garden. And it was shortly after that that I signed with the label. And they, Joel Lindsay, who's A&R and also producer and a songwriter and dear man, another friend, just love that title, you know. And I said, well, I love it for an album because the garden of, you know, this sort of fertile ground my parents provided for me in terms of exposing me to all these different kinds of music and different opportunities, and giving me a background that embraced all of these things, is the garden from whence it all comes, you know. So I love the idea of Back to the Garden because all of these genres come from this one source for me. And that's how we came up with the title. And then the things that wound up ultimately on the album are all things that fall under that heading. You'll Never Know, which is an Oscar winning, is the first song I ever learned. I was 4 years old and my mother taught me that song in the kitchen. I think probably to get me to stop asking her questions. Work and trying to make dinner, and I was talking, because that's what I did. And I think she said, you know, go learn this song in your room and you can come back and sing it for me and dad. So that was, you know, my first gig. So I've always loved that song. And luckily for me, I mentioned it to Wayne, and Wayne loved that song too. There's something so pure about that tune. Mm-hmm. And then Wayne said, you know, in this one of these meetings we were together in the rehearsal studio, you know what I'm a big fan of? I don't know if this is your thing, but I love Pearl Bailey. I said, oh my God, me too. I love Pearl Bailey. You know, and he said, oh, okay, I want to play this for you. And he played her version of Who with I think she recorded it with the Charioteers in 1930 something, 40 something. And it's so adorable and it's so much fun. And I was like, yes, 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 I love that. Let's figure out our version of that. So that's the oldest song. And the album in that song is from 1925.
Who stole my heart away? Who makes me dream all day? Dreams I know can never be true. Seems as though I'll ever be blue. Who means my happiness? Who will I answer yes to? Well, you are a guest. Me dream all day, dreams I dream that never come true. Seems as though I'll ever be blue. Who means my happiness? Who will you answer yes to? Well, you ought to guess who, no one but you.
all of these different things that thrill me. We recorded the Lionel Bart tune because when I was doing the Shirley Bassey tribute, I found a piece of footage, a little video clip from a variety show she did, I think in the 70s, with this song I'd never heard before. And I had to find out what this song was because I couldn't find a recording of it anywhere. I couldn't find out much information about it. So I did a deep dive and I found that when she was auditioning for the film of Oliver, he wanted her for Nancy, Lionel Bart wanted her for Nancy and she wanted the part. But the powers that be did not. So they kept calling her back in and Lionel kept writing more material for her to add to the score that existed for the musical. Just for Shirley, kind of songs that would be, you know, her moment. And this was one of them. And so she didn't get the part and the song got trashed. It didn't become part of the score. And she was supposed to record it on an album and it never happened. So this song has just been sort of drifting mm-hmm. in limbo since 60 something. And I just thought it was amazing.
It's a great song. It's a wonderful song.
And the thing I love about Shirley Bassey, the reason I fell in love with Shirley Bassey as a kid is it's, you know, it's full throated singing and it's all of the melodrama, but she means it, you know, and that's what I love about her. I love that. I think one of the things that appeals to me about some of these artists like that, like Shirley Bassey, Sammy Davis Jr., certain artists who, you know, there's a certain school of thought that they're not cool, you know, that they're not modern, you know, mm-hmm. but I disagree because I think people have big feelings and there are songs about big feelings and they're big and everything isn't ironic. You know, everything isn't tongue in cheek. Some people mean what they say, and feel the things and talk about the way they feel. And I love those stuff. So I'm a big fan of this kind of full on emotion.
When he lives in a world of his own, how do you make the man listen when the man you love stands alone?
And then there's something like Trust in Me, which is a
right.
Disney tune.
I wanted to ask about that one because the choosing that is so out of left field because it's, I mean, it really is because of all the songs to pick from Jungle Book, it's not one of the most well-known songs from Jungle Book,
but it's
a perfect song for you. And it's a perfect song to interpret, right?
Right. I love it. I was obsessed with the Jungle Book when I was a kid. I sang it incessantly, mostly Bare Necessities, though. That was my big hit at home, singing to the stuffed animals and the cats, because that was my audience as a kid. But I really loved that entire album and played it over and over and over again. I went to a private girl school and both my parents worked. So I was a latchkey kid. And when I got home from school, what I did to entertain myself between the time I was home alone and mom and dad got home was listen to records. That's what I did. So I put on little shows and, you know, for myself and all of that. I was not a lonely only child. Mm-hmm. because I created all kinds of worlds for myself. So I loved that album. I listened to it a million times. And we started talking about Disney songs just in general. You know, I don't even remember how it came up, but Wayne and I were just talking about it. I think one day over lunch, not even like specifically a this is for the album conversation. But he suggested something, another song that he thought I should look at for the album. And I said, oh, are you thinking a Disney song we should record, you know? And he said, yeah, why not? Like, let's add that piece. It's part of my growing up. I mean, for most of us, you know. So I thought, okay, let me think about it. And I suddenly thought of Trust in Me just because I always loved how subversive it was. that as a kid, there were so many pieces of that lyric I didn't get, or I only got in one way, you know? And yet as I got older, and heard the song again, there's this undercurrent that you could make, you know, rather than subtext. Mm-hmm. and I thought that sounded like fun. Like, let's do that. Let's try that and see what happens. So we talked about it and, Wayne loved that idea. And I was thrilled that it came out as well as it did. Because it was a lot of fun to do.
Trust in me, just in me. Close your eyes. Trust in me. Will cease to resist. Just relax, be at rest like a bird in a silver mist. your senses will cease to resist. Trust in
album is actually a mixture of some things that I've been singing for a while and that mean a lot to me, these songs I love, and arrangements that already existed. And then some things that we created just for this album, because we, you know, they wrote an original song for me, which is so fab and I love it. And then Trust in Me, I had never sung for real. You know, it was something I'd only sung as a kid.
Well, it should be. I'm assuming it's going to be part of your repertoire now.
Oh yeah, oh yeah, oh, I love it now. Yeah. Well, it's got so many colors, you know, and it's
right. I think it's one of those ones that you need to throw into your concerts and not tell people beforehand where it's from.
Right. Oh yeah,
wait till the song is over and then remind them, because they're going to be sitting there going, "I know this song, and what is this from?" And then when they remember, then when you tell them, they're going to go, "Oh." And because you're right, it's one of those songs that's got so many layers to it, you know, because it's a song that it's used to hypnotize Mowgli in the movie, but it's also a very sexual seduction song now when it's sung by an adult. So it has a totally different slant to it, which gives it a whole different angle. But one of the things I really love about the album is that even though it is a mix of new material for you, plus songs that are sort of like your greatest hits from your concert stuff, that it all works very consistently. There's a nice tone to the entire album that it feels all of one piece. Do you know what I mean? It's everything, because of the arrangements and the way it's all put together, the album feels much of one piece. So that doesn't feel like it's pulled from separate pieces. It all blends really nicely together. So it all really feels complete.
Yeah, I do love that. I think that, you know, that's thanks to Wayne and some of the choices that we made, just in terms of what bit, and what we needed, you know, what's the next thing this album needs. I think some of the benefit of that comes from having programmed a lot of different shows and done a lot of different shows in a lot of different settings for lots of different audiences all over the world, and people who know me already, people who don't know me, for whom I'm a total stranger, people who've come to see me, people who just are there. You know, I've done like cruise work and they don't come to see me specifically. They're there, you know, and you have to figure out a way to create a show that's entertaining for all those disparate groups, you know, and sometimes you have those disparate groups in one room. And it still has to be entertaining for everyone. You know, when I do these tribute shows, I don't just do the greatest hits, because there are some super fans coming and they will be disappointed if they don't hear any deep cuts, you know, in Dolly Parton show, they don't just want to hear 9 to 5, you know? But there are people coming who will be disappointed if they don't hear 9 to 5. You know? So, and then one of the great things about working at Birdland is that you've got people coming to that club who are just in New York City and want to come to Birdland. And so they have no idea what's happening tonight at 7, you know, and they come in and sit down and listen to you for the first time ever. Sometimes they don't know me and they don't know the artists I'm celebrating, but I still have to do something that's engaging for them and that will be accessible. So I really try hard to find stories and songs that people can latch onto and can find their own way in quickly enough. You know, I learned sort of in all my years of piano bar that, you know, so many of us, when we start doing this singing live, especially if you are not a songwriter and you are singing covers, we tend to want to show off the like undiscovered Cole Porter Trunk song that we found, you know, Little Sung. He wrote it and then he threw it away and it's only been recorded once and, you know, those kinds of obscure things. And that's fun for the super like nerds about that kind of musicology. But often for a general audience, that's not accessible.
Right.
You know? Or there's a reason he threw that away. You know, mm-hmm. It's not so mm-hmm. great. And if you do an entire program of the most obscure things you know, that isn't always satisfying for people. They may, you know, admire the artistry, admire your facility with the material, but I don't know that it touches them. And that's your job, really, to connect, you know, not just to show them what you know and what
right.
you can do.
It's always tricky. You know, you can throw in a couple of those songs, but you've got to throw in, if you really want to connect with your audience, the familiar is an easier way to do that. Because they like to they want to hear familiar stuff a lot of times.
Yeah. If you structure a show properly, you can introduce new things to people all the time. Like the song we were talking about, the Lionel Bart song, that is in the Shirley Bassey show, but it's later in the Shirley Bassey show. I don't open that show with something that you've never heard unless you are a super fan, you know? In my 60 show, there's a piece that I do that's from the Dolly show. It's one of Dolly Parton's songs from 63. She wrote about an unwed mother. It's little known if you are not a super Dolly fan, but super Dolly fans mostly know it because it's a gorgeous piece of writing. It's so well done. And it's called Down from Dover. People don't expect that in a 60s show, but I like to give you some of the 60s stuff you're expecting. Yes, there's some Beatles. Yes, mm-hmm. there's some Jack. Yes, there's some Joni. But I also want to, you know, there was a lot happening musically in the 60s. Nancy Wilson. And if you say 60s to people, it means lots of different things. So I like to throw in those little curves, those little things you're not expecting. And if you don't give somebody a steady diet of it, like, you know, an entire show of it, I think it can be, it's like spice and they love it. You know, like, oh, here's something I didn't know that. What's this song? And I get excited when people come to me and they're dying to know what this is, you know? So there's certain songwriters I go to for that. Susan Werner is one of the contemporary ones that I go to. If you don't know her work, she has huge, she's very popular and she has lots of fans, but there are people who don't know her work. Or they only know some of the songs she's written that are funny. You know, they don't know the things she's written that are more thoughtful or that are sort of satirical or that are political. And so she's somebody I go to, you know, to sprinkle into shows when people are not expecting it.
So you are out and about soon. As we're winding down here, I want to let people know to go see you because I know in April, you are going to be in Florida, and then you're going to be out here in California. And they can find your website at nataliedouglas.com and find where you're going to be. And then you are going to be in May. You've got a whole series of dates at the Pheasantry in London. Have you been performing in London before, right?
This will be our 12th show in London. I've been performing there. I was there in 2004, but then didn't go back until 2013. And then since 2013, we usually go like once every 18 months or so, barring lockdown-y times. So I think this is our 11th or 12th show. And I love performing in London. It's one of my favorite cities. And we have very good friends there. And we always have a great time when we go.
People can find you in London. And they can find you online. So they'll find you at nataliedouglas.com. I will make sure to include a link on the website so they can find Natalie. And remember to find your brand new album, Back to the Garden, on Club 44 Records, which we have been talking about and listening to some tracks. I want to thank Natalie. It's been such a pleasure chatting with you, a native Angeleno like me.
Fellow Angeleno.
Yes. Congratulations again on this fantastic album. It's such a great listen. And remember, people, don't just stream. Please purchase a download or purchase the actual physical CD. It's so nice to have the physical CD because you can actually read all the credits and you can hold it in your little hand. Yes, the pictures are really nice. So please purchase. Don't just stream, because that helps. That helps everybody. So thank you again, Natalie.
Thank you. Bye, Donald.
Darling, I'm so blue without you. I think about you the livelong day. When you ask me if I'm lonely, then I have only this to say. You never know just how much I miss you. You'll never know just how much I care. Haven't I told you so? A million or more times you went away and my heart went with you. I speak your name in my ear. I swear I don't know how. You'll never know if you don't know I swear.